The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by One More. Treat your ears. One More's mission is to bring innovation, design, and quality to all music lovers, young or old, frugal or spendy. Offering an incredible collection of earbuds at all tiers of the market, cabled or Bluetooth, neckband or true wireless. Fantastic sound quality, top-tier tuning, excellent noise reduction. I've personally been a fan for a couple years now. Right now, my headphone of choice is the Dual Driver ANC Pro neckband. Great battery life, punchy dynamic sound, and crazy good noise reduction in a very convenient just drop your earbud neckband design. Or you can get those same features and completely cut the cords with the Dual Driver ANC True Wireless, one of the absolute best options in the completely cable-free space. Or maybe you want to fill a decently large room with a pair of One More portable Bluetooth speakers. There's a whole collection of great audio options for you to shop at affordable prices. And for listeners of this podcast, I can also do you one better. If you shop at onemore.com, use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout. Once again, SOMEGADGETGUY10 with no spaces. You'll save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. You'd spend over $80 less on One More's Dual Driver ANC True Wireless compared to that other brand's Pro earbuds. You know who I'm talking about. One More brings style, premium audio quality, and cool tech features to the table at prices that won't hurt the wallet. You can check out these multiple award-winning audio solutions at onemore.com. And remember to use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY10 at checkout to save some scratch. All right. I believe this means we are live. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, the SGG of this terribly named podcast series. But the Q&A is the important part because we like to have a more engaged and interactive conversation on all the tech news that we cover from week to week. That's why I like to hold my show on a Monday. We can kind of sort out the last week of news. Maybe some news broke over the weekend. And we can kind of start working through it, especially with following up on these various news stories, making sure we're keeping our eye on the prize. Who knew that a major smartphone manufacturer would hold such an important announcement over the future of their smartphone division for my 200th episode? I mean, it's almost like they planned it that way. Hey, we know Juan's out there, and his podcast is coming up on kind of an important number. I think now's the right time to go on this announcement. I'm, of course, chatting out one of the major topics, one of the major stories we're going to be sharing some feels on in the second half of the podcast in the gadget block is LG pulling out of the smartphone market. So I didn't jinx it, F. Mooney. I feel like instead, if LG were looking at the right time to make an announcement, it's all for the good of my podcast. So we've got a lot of other stories to talk about. And we definitely need to chew through some housekeeping, but I do want to start, Dave Burns, can we all collectively facepalm to get it out of techies beforehand? What Dave Burns is sort of pointing to is all of the sad thumbnails that we're going to see, the contemplative ones, I've got an Excedrin headache. I need two Excedrin because LG, some are even going to cover their face. And then they're all coming from people that I have almost no relationship to the brand or with the products. But let me tell you the hot takes. You know, I think LG, you know, they should have done something about those boot loops 6 years ago. So We've got a lot to cover there. I want to start off, just first of all, if you're of that practicing sect of individuals, I hope you had a lovely Easter weekend. Marie and I staged some Easter bunny activities for Lex and made sure that there was a basket with some eggs and some candy and some chocolates ready to go. It was a remarkable. I keep wanting to call her a toddler, but she's five. Like, she's just a little kid now. It's crazy how fast your kids grow up. But I pretty much leaned on the OnePlus 9 Pro for a lot of like the egg dyeing that we did. And after this most recent update, I am just consistently impressed. Not just with like how it processes color, does the fancy HDR tricks. So far, the OnePlus 9 Pro has proven to be one of the best options I've ever used. Not just, oh, it's pretty good for a OnePlus. One of the best options I've ever used for freezing action in almost all lighting conditions. So, you know, we're just at our dining room table. It's kind of like a hard, almost backlit because where our dining room lamps are. And Lex is dumping eggs into little cups of dye. And the OnePlus 9 is just snapping those shots. It was pretty impressive. I might share a few where her face isn't on there because we just don't really share photos of Lex publicly. So, oh, wow. We've got a group of gift subs coming in. Gary the Fireman. Hey, thanks, man. I really appreciate that. Tier 1 subs to Boing Bite, JMX Warrior, Tummick 102, Mr. Pulp Fiction, and Squishy Man 2007. Thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that, especially on this episode, especially on episode 200. You know, again, it's always appreciated when folks are out there supporting content, supporting these streams. And Gary, especially, I mean, you've been on it, man. So I really appreciate that. So why don't we knock out some housekeeping here? Because I did a lot. Last week was real busy. I kind of feel like this next week is probably going to be pretty busy, too. So I think I'm going to kind of do this a little backwards. Yes. Okay. So first of all, Saturday night was a really fun night. I got to jump in on the stream with Tech King Mike, where Tech King likes to stage sort of tech fights. So this is the Saturday night tech fight, iPhone versus Pixel, with Scott Peachy and Digital Slang, sort of debating out, you know, the iPhone ecosystem versus the Google and Pixel ecosystem. I was one of the judges, and you can totally tell by this thumbnail how animated I was. I feel like this is a poor representation of how I was acting as a judge. I feel like I was more engaged and happier. But yes, this was a really fun live stream. Following that up, I got a video out for reviews.org taking a look at the new beta program for Starlink. So SpaceX is going to be opening up early beta access for Starlink internet access. And we're trying to see, is this going to be a potential solution for those folks that are having a harder time getting connected, especially in more rural situations. Then on Thursday, we did TK and I had a really fun stream chatting out a lot of Xiaomi. So both of us were playing with the Xiaomi Mi 11 Lite, and definitely an interesting smartphone experience for me, because I would say Xiaomi is probably the brand I have the least familiarity with. So even my first video isn't a review. Like, you can't call it a review because, like, I'm still getting up to speed on all of the little ins and outs and peculiarities of what Xiaomi has to offer. So those were just some of the big streams. Kicking back over to the website. Oh, there was more. So a major article. I'm not doing these as videos anymore just because the YouTube algorithm sucks. And apparently a lot of techies just don't really care about smartphone performance. So these are now written articles. And if you're interested in how these different devices fare, the OnePlus 9 Pro by the benchmarks, better performance for the price. So I'm writing a script kind of comparing the Galaxy S21s versus the OnePlus 9s. I mean, it's fine if you don't care about features and performance and you want to stick with the Samsung label. if you care about getting the better bang for buck, I think OnePlus is building the better all-rounder phones this year. That's not to say that, you know, like an individual might not prefer, you know, a solution like DeX, right? I'm a big fan of DeX. But when I look at gaming performance, where the OnePlus 9 is crushing it, when I look at photo editing performance, when I look at file compression, video rendering, all of these individual tasks that I put smartphones through, and the phone runs cooler, the phone runs more consistently, the phone feels just as snappy when you have adaptive 120 hertz. And especially like OnePlus 9 Pro versus Galaxy S21 Plus, I just don't see, there's going to be a video out. I'm feeling real strong on the OnePlus 9s. I think they are not only more than competitive against what we consider flagships now, I think they score a few critical victories against how Samsung is kind of cheaping out on the S21s this year. So, moving right along, this was the major project I've been working really hard on this for a couple of weeks now, but we finally polished it all up, got it all edited, got all our approvals, had to work through legal. Qualcomm, Snapdragon Sound explained an interview about next generation wireless audio. I am super stoked to be kicking off some of these conversations. Sarah, the product specialist from Qualcomm is just absolutely adorable. Just a really, really, really fun conversation and kind of digging into some of the nooks and crannies and kicking off what should be an interesting platform and an interesting product line to kind of look at as this program evolves. And I'm hoping it does what Qualcomm is trying to position it for. I think it would be a benefit for some consumers out there just to see sort of a simpler certification label, as opposed to looking through, oh, does it have this codec? Is it on this version of Bluetooth? How does this work? So it's a 14 minute. I mean, I cut it down a lot, and I might try and go back later and do like a longer run, just sort of a longer podcast version of the conversation. But in this 14 minutes, Sarah is on point, and she's got a lot of great insights on what it is that they're trying to do for, it's not just one kind of technology, it's more of a certifications process. So I hope folks check that out. If you're inclined to care about your ears, hopefully you can give it a share. A lot of work behind the scenes went into making a nice video for that conversation. Coming back to some of the other things that we posted, TK and I talked about this a lot, but I do have a standalone video on the Mi 11 Lite. I am very taken with this hardware. When we're looking at some of the sub $400 options in the market, TCLs, OnePlus Nords, the Motorola series. I mean, Motos have always been really strong in this space, but especially with those three brands here in the United States, and I'm very positive on those three. They all kind of fit a very similar vibe. LCD screens, headphone jacks, larger, curvier plastic bodies, but solid performers, like absolutely nails a daily driver experience. Like if your needs are some social media communication, maybe a little entertainment, like I don't see much benefit of shopping above like $400. And a lot of them playing with like, you know, 5G now, especially like the Motos and the Nords. So picking up the Mi 11, and it's got a very different build aesthetic. That was a fun sort of a transfer. You know, that was a fun tangent, I should say, from the traditional $300 to $400 phones that I played with in the past. This one feels unique. A lot of it's aesthetic, but that still matters for someone who might be shopping a phone, doesn't have a bankroll to go and like lease a $1,000 phone, but wants something that's still going to feel like a nice premium daily driver and is plenty powerful. Like again, I'm consistently impressed with what these like mid-ranger phones are capable of. Two more, and then we're wrapping it up with housekeeping. Who knew that my favorite smartwatch manufacturer also makes a treadmill? I feel like that's a really good product and brand pairing. So I am usually wearing a Mobvoi Tick Watch as my favorite smartwatch. And they sent over a treadmill for me to kind of break in for a bit. This one took a long time to shoot. My home is not camera ready. We have a five-year-old. Marie is working from home. We're in a space that's probably a little too small right now for our current needs. And it's just, there's stuff everywhere. It's kind of an explosion. So finding a spot where we could really use it and where I could shoot even halfway passable video in this treadmill was a much larger challenge than I was expecting. F. Mooney, how does the treadmill feel in the hand? Well, you see, when Mobvoi ships it, it comes mostly pre-assembled, so it feels really nice in the hand as you're pulling it out of the box, so you can simply set it up. Yeah, El Jefe, not camera ready, story of my life. Again, our setups are very similar for a reason. Like, this field of view that you see on my live streams and on a lot of my videos is kind of the mandatory head in a vise camera angle. Because if I move this too far in any one direction, you're just going to see an explosion of boxes and packing stuff and reviews that are halfway through being shot or filmed or produced. So it's, it's real messy. And lastly, just to kind of cap off, housekeeping. Let me get this back. I had a video ready to go. I feel like the writing was on the wall. We were all pretty confident that this was going to be announced by LG, but I held off until we got the official press release that they were going to be leaving the smartphone market because I hoped that there would be some kind of Hail Mary or someone would buy the smartphone division at the last second. That didn't come to pass. So Sunday night, Monday, South Korea time, they put out the press release and I published goodbye LG smartphones from an actual LG fan. And like I said, we're going to save that for the gadget block. Just take our time on kind of sorting that kind of stuff out. But I still do want to cover some news and see what, kind of see where we're following up on some of these other stories here. So all of the, excuse me. Man, my voice is already failing me and it's Monday. All of the stories that we're going to be talking about, all of the links, all of the show notes, everything's going to be available after this broadcast, somegadgetguy.com. So definitely check that out if you want to get the full scoop on what's happening in the world of tech. Kyoto Santi, how did it feel on your feet? Okay, I actually talked about that in the review. Yeah. In the Mobvoi treadmill review, I actually did mention, you know, like there's a particular kind of running style that you need to use on a smaller belt-driven treadmill. I wonder what my thoughts were on that. All right, All Greg is telling me to stretch and Paco Sin is telling me to check my posture. All right. Ooh. Oh, hope that doesn't come in too ASMR. But yeah, I kind of needed that. Just got my neck kind of properly aligned there. All right, let's jump into some news. A quick news block story. I'm assuming that most people in this have already sort of minimized or deleted their Facebook use. Because over 533 million Facebook users' phone numbers and personal data has been leaked online. So if you were engaged with Facebook from, you know, 2019, it's very statistically likely that you might be one of these people. So this was written up by Adam Bankhurst over on IGN. As reported by Business Insider, this exposed data is from users from 106 countries, including over 32 million records on users in the United States, 11 million on users in the UK, and 6 million users in India. The data leaked includes phone numbers, Facebook IDs, full names, locations, birth dates, bios, and even some email addresses. Fortunately for those who recently changed their information, a Facebook spokesperson told Insider that the data was scraped due to a vulnerability that the company patched in 2019. Well, I can't say. I mean, I think the last time I was really seriously using Facebook was probably back in 2018. And I don't know how current any of my stuff is there, but we'll have to see what kind of resources there are or are going to be made available for Facebook users to check and see what data has been compromised. It's like example after example after example after example of doing business with Facebook in any regard is probably bad for your business. If you're trying to build a fan page, they actively stand in between you and your audience to extort money out of the followers that you already have, let alone help you find more followers. It's not a platform for growth. It's a platform for extracting value from all the work you do building up a fan base. If you're just a regular user, you just want to use Facebook for personal reasons. Years of data that shows us they cannot keep your data safe because their business model is selling and leaking your data. I mean, it's not, at this point, we have to acknowledge it's not a bug. This is the feature of Facebook. Dave Burns, are you telling me Facebook, a company rife with privacy violations and known for leaky software, accidentally allowed 500 million people's info to be scraped and sold online? I, for one, am just shocked. / sarcasm. And JJ, I know, man, I'm trying so hard. Boomers do not want to jump ship. Chatty boy, my mom's data was leaked. I checked the data dump. I'm really sorry to hear that. But again, this is another prod point. This is another pressure point that we can apply. You know, it's been interesting. Like, I think my mom has significantly curtailed her Facebook use. And I think it's because in light of shelter in place and quarantine orders, like, other platforms have kind of popped up. You know, she's a lot more familiar making Duo calls and jumping on Zoom conferences and stuff like that. And so I feel like this is also the stuff that we can kind of help push people away from just passively scanning a Facebook feed and saying, hey, you want to link up with people. It's so much easier. There are all these opportunities for you, platforms to use, things that you can take advantage of. And it doesn't have to be this outrage machine of the worst that people have to offer in their daily lives. Because again, Facebook's business model also kind of depends on you feeling awful about everything so that you keep doom scrolling on Facebook. So really, the reason why I wanted to bring this up isn't just like, oh, Facebook bad. I'm going to take every opportunity I can to hammer home, oh, Facebook bad. But we need to keep an eye on this story in particular because a data breach of this severe, we now need to see what government responses are. Especially, I mean, the region to watch first, I think, would be the EU. What was the point of engaging with all of this privacy and data protection and data security legislation and setting up these regulations in the EU? Someone correct me if I'm wrong. Depending on what interpretation of the violation you're reading, isn't it something like they could be fined 200 million euros or 4% of their annual revenue, not profit, but their annual revenue over significant breaches in data security? If we don't make this kind of business very sensitive to regulations and fines, then companies are going to keep doing this. You know, they don't pay any costs here. They're going to say, oopsie, sorry, we're really sorry, but we leaked all your data. I guess now you need to go and do all the legwork to make sure everything in your sort of sphere of influence is safe. But if this cost them, if this hurt their financials, I think a lot of businesses would start taking their data security and data privacy initiatives a lot more seriously. So this is where I'm curious. Are we going to see that first first utilization of EU regulations to go after their money? And not just like, well, we fined you $5 million. We're doing our job. Because that's barely a blip on a Facebook financials feed. But if they see 4% of revenue going to the EU in fines, and they have to send armies of lawyers to try and combat those types of regulatory actions, we might actually see some progress. Like, that might actually get the ball rolling on some stuff. Oh, and Fat Produce just subscribed with Prime. Aw, thanks, buddy. Hey, Andrew, I really appreciate that. From the Sentinel 909, everyone seems to know Facebook equals bad by now, but nothing has managed to push people off using it, at least sporadically. So here's the deal. I like to look at my family as a tip of the fear, tip of the spear. Tip of the fear is also a really good Freudian slip there. You know, I didn't realize how tech savvy we were growing up. You know, we were one of the first families on the block with a home PC. I was doing message boards and online communication, you know, like when I was 8, you know, before anyone really had modems attached to these things. Our 8088 had dual floppies and a hard drive. I mean, like you kind of take that stuff for granted. When you're a kid, you think, oh, this is how everyone else is growing up. And then later in life, you realize like, oh, no, I'm speaking a foreign language to some of my friends here. So when my mom is actively convincing other members of her generation to communicate on other platforms and to move to other messaging services and to share photos in private circles, and she's actively pushing Duo and Zoom and what was the other one that we jumped on? There was like a Google Meet or something like that. When that starts happening at the top, the tiny percentage of like our parents and grandparents' generations that are starting to pay attention to that, the ripple effect on that can be profound. I feel this is the right time to, again, I mentioned this story because I feel this is another prod. It's another reminder. It's another push. It's another step. You know, at some point, this becomes unfashionable. And it's already unfashionable with young people. It's already unfashionable with people my age. And we're watching the actual utilization of these services plummet. So this one feels like it's going to nudge. Not like it's going to be night and day. Like, oh, next week, Facebook's going to be, you know, is going to disappear because no one's going to use it. That's not realistic. But when we see an overwhelming reaction and response to an organization performing this poorly at doing what they're supposed to be good at, you know, it helps us move the goalposts a little bit further, a little bit further, a little bit further. And more people are going to start falling behind that threshold. And that's a good thing. That's what we should be encouraging. I think it's better and it's healthier for the future of our society. To encourage Facebook to radically alter their business. JMX Warrior, I'm nudging friends to signal. My stepfamily called me unsociable because I'm not on Facebook. McCorcoran, it's why I won't buy an Oculus. I'm kind of in the same boat. Like, I really want a cableless kind of console quality a VR solution, but I can't bring myself to let Facebook scan. Oh, but it's so much less expensive. And you're like, yeah, it's less expensive because you are subsidizing Facebook's business model by supplying them with more data to track. They want to do a profit share. I'm all for that. Just give me the hardware for free and then we'll split the costs on what data I generate. And then if this data is valuable, then they can put a monetary value on it and we'll just go halvesies. I feel like that's fair. Let's do that. All right. And F. Mooney, this is exactly a part of it, too. Having Instagram is huge for them, though. But again, it's not like they're indomitable. An entire generation is coming up on alt services to stay away from their parents. You know, again, the rise of TikTok isn't because TikTok is such a great service. It's because parents weren't on it. Everything you can do in TikTok is eminently replicatable on any other service or platform that can share video. There's nothing special about TikTok. What's special is building an architecture and a framework that provides some separation or exclusivity for where the traditional older generations of users are. All right, let's move on to another story here. Again, just another kind of shift in a business model that I think is going to be interesting to keep an eye on. I don't feel like this a lot of these stories are sort of the beginnings of and things that we need to follow up on. So let me click this back over here. This is written up by Dieter over at The Verge. T-Mobile is betting big on Google's Android services, RCS, YouTube TV, Pixel, and more. Google and T-Mobile are announcing a huge partnership today, with the carrier agreeing to showcase a suite of Google services on Android phones sold on the carrier's network. The list includes officially supporting Google's Android messages with RCS on all of T-Mobile's Android phones, dropping T-Mobile's own TV services for Google's YouTube TV, showcasing Google One as the default backup service, and expanding support and sales of Google hardware like the Pixel. So Team Pixel folks, I'm sure, are going to be lit up about this. Again, I can kind of see Peachy, you know, like Scott, doing like a little wiggle dance, because he's like, yeah, because Pixel. but again, if these types of strategic partnerships put a Pixel phone one table up so that it's somehow nearer Samsungs and iPhones, then that's an excellent move for competition in the carrier space. Again, we've got some hard questions to ask in light of LG leaving the smartphone market. But, you know, moves like this, I think, are strategic and very could be beneficial. I shouldn't say are beneficial. They could be beneficial to consumers getting a more unified experience. The whole rollout of RCS has been frustrating because every carrier kind of wanted to define the spec based on their own wants. And of course, I mean, just like payments back in the day, you know, we had ISIS versus Google Wallet, and the two were feuding, which allowed Apple Pay to cement a foothold and become sort of a de facto standard in smartphone payments. We've been struggling with this in messaging. You know, iMessage keeps people locked into the Apple ecosystem for a very good reason, and that it's a broadly unified messaging platform that services about 50% of the smartphone consumers in the United States. So again, when we started watching the early chatter on RCS and seeing every carrier try and fight, or we can't let Google define this spec, or we've got to do this, or we're going to have this flavor of messaging and we're going to make you use this app to do it, we knew it was going to be the same thing. We knew it was just going to be an utter mess of conflicting standards and a miserably inconsistent experience for all consumers looking to shop other devices. So, you know, I feel like it's smart. Instead of building up your own TV service in an age where I don't think it really behooves a carrier right now to invest super heavy on their own media streaming solutions. If anything, especially what we saw, we talked about either last week or 2 weeks back, you know, AT&T was really cranky because now they couldn't prioritize the data on some services and then charge other services more so that the data wouldn't affect the data caps of their customers, which is really anti-net neutrality. It's kind of a nice perk for an individual in the short term, but it just jacks up costs. It makes AT&T kind of an annoying middleman. You know, AT&T doesn't bring much value to the table. They're instead just standing in between a service and a subscriber to extract wealth from both as they're kind of passing data back and forth. So instead of T-Mobile really trying to build their own TV streaming service, it kind of makes more sense to do some kind of partnership. They've done partnerships with Netflix, doing a partnership with YouTube TV. Instead of building their own unique cloud storage options, why not just go with a company that already has a really robust framework for cloud? You know, like, this kind of stuff makes more sense to me, that T-Mobile should be focusing on certain core deliveries as opposed to reinventing the wheel and forcing their consumers to use duplicated apps on their Android phones. From ER1980, this T-Mobile link-up is beginning to make more sense with Google Messages, RCS getting end-to-end encryption, with Whitechapel SoC coming up, with more long-term software support following on future Pixel devices. Would be great to see Sony link up with the carrier, with LG disappearing from the US market. We here in the UK have been fortunate to see Sony link up with some carriers. So, yeah, and we're going to talk about Whitechapel
after the Reddit break.
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r/glowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
But I'm positive on this. I'm still a Google Fi subscriber, but when I see T-Mobile making moves like that, I feel it's a smart play. I think this is going to be my last story for the news block. There's a lot of gadgety stuff that I'd like to dig into a little bit more. So I had a couple other stories, but this one is a follow-up. Again, I can't remember if it was last week or 2 or 3 weeks ago. Excuse me. Yeah, I can't remember. We talked about how certain regions of the world require phone manufacturers to kind of play by different rules. Man, that's a really clumsy way of putting that. Specifically, we can look at Apple's business model here in the United States and their major marketing push on things like data privacy and data security, and then how that changes when Apple wants to sell a phone in China, or more recently, how Apple was bending to the pressure of Russian regulators as Russia is looking to encourage Russian apps pre-installed on various smartphones. Apple's solution is kind of a halfway step. It's a little like the splash screen that we used to do on Windows PCs way back in the day. So you could choose your browser when you were setting up a new computer. That's a little like what Apple is doing now. So when you're setting up an iPhone in Russia, there's a splash screen that if you'd like to install some of these Russian-backed apps and services, you can do that as part of the setup process. And again, this is interesting to see how Apple is going to work this, because a major part of their messaging is all about, hey, you know, iPhones are more secure. Hey, your privacy is better protected. But to do business in Russia, they're having to put on apps that we'll have to see whether or not they represent more of a consumer privacy risk, or if they traffic information directly to the Russian state agencies. It's really complicated and spiderwebby, tangled kinds of conversations on regions, markets, and different products. I was all really rambly, just trying to remind where we were with Apple, because Samsung's taken it a step further. Apple is making this an opt-in. Samsung is just pre-installing these apps. So this is translated from Medusa.io. Samsung began installing Yandex applications on smartphones for Russian users. They cannot be deleted. Users of Samsung smartphones began to complain. Users of Samsung smartphones began to complain on social networks that after updating the operating system, they had Yandex Browser, Yandex Disk, and Yandex Maps, applications that could not be removed. Samsung explained this by the requirement for mandatory pre-installation of Russian applications on phones, tablets, computers, and smart TVs. It will come into force on April 1st. The ministry clarified that the pre-installation requirement applies to devices released after April 1st, but manufacturers could begin to comply with the law earlier. So, again, we need to point this out. There is a difference here between how Apple is enacting this new policy and how Samsung is. Apple is making the installation of these apps opt-in with phones released after April 1st. Samsung is pre-installing them, is preventing you from deleting them, and is working backwards to make those installations mandatory on older devices with new updates of One UI. So I feel like that is a tangible and structural difference between how these two companies are complying with the same set of regulations. Whether or not that's to curry favor, whether or not that's to get in better with Russian regulators, to appease, you know, members of the Russian government, it's disappointing. It's disappointing to see that as a business practice, because I think we'd all agree, even when it's just carrier apps, we just got done talking about T-Mobile kind of backing off some of their own duplicated software and services. Because they're annoying. It's annoying to fire up a new phone and like see two versions of calculator and two versions of browser and two versions of calendar. Even when I'm just looking at like my voicemail, like there's a carrier app for voicemail and like I gotta roll my eyes. So definitely something to keep an eye on. I'm curious how other companies are going to handle this. So someone please, enlighten me, because I'm not sure what some of the other larger players might be in the Russian market. For some reason in my head, I thought Xiaomi was pretty strong, in Eastern Europe. So I'd be curious to see, you know, like, is every Android manufacturer going to make this the same kind of mandatory, uninstallable, locked into the ROM and pre-installed upon setup? Or will a few other players at least try and sidestep like Apple has, making these, you know, not mandatory, just, you know, as part of the setup, you could choose to grab some of those. All right, sorry, I just looked in the live chat and people are trying to spell out LG with emotes of my face. Godspeed, you crazy, wacky guys, you Godspeed. From AllGreg38, you can still delete them with root, Juan. Again, if the answer is rooting or flashing ROMs, then you've alienated, 99.3% of the smartphone audience. I get... viscerally upset when I'm digging a phone, I'm going through, I'm kind of customizing it, and I get to my app list and I can't uninstall Facebook. Like, I don't want anything Facebook software adjacent on my phone. I want none of it. And then I get there, and I was like, well, you can disable it. And you're like, it's still taking up space. And I don't want to have to go through the process of trying to find an exploiter root. I want to have to like ADB commands. No. There's a reason why our phones have an app list. And in that app list, we can push uninstall. That's the way it should work. I mean, even if you want to do something dumb, you know, like I had an aunt that once deleted, the C drive on her computer because it was full of just a bunch of nonsense garbage files and she nuked her entire operating system. That's frustrating, and I felt for her, and we all had a good laugh about it when she got her computer fixed. But that's the kind of open transparency. That's the kind of user experience I would like to foster. You're gonna give me a product. I should be able to control how I interact with it. And I shouldn't need to go down deep dive tutorials on XDA to try and get some sense of how to correct for bad business practices. So that's all the news. We're going to wrap up the news block here. I'm trying to push this a little early so that we can kind of spend some time on the gadget block. And really, I mean, like the last half of this being mostly chatting LG. But we do want to plug the subreddit real quick. Every podcast has a subreddit. Mine is no exception. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles is a way to help kind of nudge, is a way to kind of help promote, to share. It's a starting place and a resource to find content creators that are being underserved by the general YouTube algorithm. you know, again, you, if you go to YouTube and you're kind of just searching along on their recommendations, you're going to see bigger tent pole content creators. I don't know what I'm trying to say there. I'm all mixed up with feels and stuff. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, a broader, more diverse community of people sharing content that they feel deserves more attention. I'm not necessarily thrilled that I'm at the top of the Reddit this week for saying goodbye to LG smartphones, but that's where we're at. So goodbye LG smartphones from an actual LG fan. Adam Reviews Tech, taking a look at what we could expect from a Pixel 6 chipset. That could be kind of interesting. We're going to be talking about Whitechapel here later on in the show. We've got Team Vry taking a quick look back at the Pixel 4a. For April Fool's Day, I reshared my yams review. It's a 17-minute review of a yam, which I got to say, most people can't hang. You know, I went hard on this. It's 17 minutes of reviewing a tuber. And, you know, most people tap out before I even get to the collaboration I had with a sort of a stress test reviewer, doing a bend test, a scratch test, a burn test. I mean, if you can't even hang for that, you're missing some key conversation on starchy root vegetables and tubers. I stuck it out for 17 minutes. You know, I had to shoot it and edit it, so it's a pretty big deal. After that, though, my Snapdragon Sound video got a play into the top 10. Gaming on a OnePlus Nord from Team Vry. My look at the Mi 11 Lite. And then I wanted to point these out. Lisa from Mobile Tech Review scored a solid position on her OnePlus 9 Pro review. And then the 8-bit guy, what happened to America's electronics stores? This is such a loving, charming, adorable video. I cannot recommend watching this enough, especially if you're a little closer to my age. You know, I'm an 80s and 90s kid. Mall culture was a thing. You know, we would go and hang out in malls. Malls had everything. And 8-bit guide kind of takes us through an old mall catalog, an old mall brochure about all of the electronic stores that used to exist, and the computer stores and the game stores and the toy stores, and just like how radically different our consumer and our shopping experience is today. And again, coming from someone my age, where you kind of have a lot of like, you know, a lot of life feels from, you know, this is where I used to meet up with my friends, and I didn't, cell phones weren't a thing. So I couldn't just like, you know, like call my parents. Like there would just be an agreed upon time, like, hey, you've got to be home at a certain time. And someone put it really, I can't remember. I think it was like a stand up comedian, but, you know, if you were born around the time that I was, your childhood looked a lot like the childhood that you would see on TV from like the 1960s. You know, maybe a little bit more TV and a little less like vinyl and radio, but you go outside and play, and your parents would just have no clue where you were, and you'd walk to school, and like there was this whole like completely analog existence. And then as the 90s hit, we saw the change, and we were young enough to experience the change into a more digital lifestyle, pagers, cell phones, smartphones. We're the pivot, you know, this little core group of people born in like the mid 70s to the mid 80s exist in this little teeny pocket of transition. Every generation has their own transitions and challenges, but ours, I feel, is a very unique, you know, growing up, understanding and hearing from people that fought in Vietnam, watching shows like The Wonder Years, and then, you know, moving from dial up to broadband. You know, it's this little pocket. And so 8-bit guy, this video does just such an amazing job of kind of summing up what that was like going to Radio Shack, and it wasn't just a place for, you know, ISPs and cell phone carriers to dump phones. it was like this place you would go like, oh, I need a resistor and I want to get some LEDs and I want to get these little capacitors and let me do something, some soldering, you know, like it was like this workshop that you could go to. It was the first time I ever wrote, you know, code was at a Radio Shack on, I think it was an old Tandy. And I was just trying to figure out how to do like a hello world statement, you know, literally the first time I remember punching keys and getting an output from a computer. So it's you got to watch that video. And again, he's just so fun. I know he's got like, what, over a million subscribers. It's not necessarily that his channel is small or he needs help, but it's videos like that that I feel like there's a story to be told. It's not just, I picked up this tech and then I did this thing with it and I got this benchmark score. Mm. Like, if you're not doing things, if you're not making things, then what's the point? You know, what's the point of playing with any of this stuff? And again, you know, like there's so many changes that we've seen. Watch the video, hit me back up on social media when you watch the video, because I feel like that's like a whole conversation to be had, but I don't want to spoil it. Like, I don't want to just take his points and like regurgitate them and do a reacts video on his really awesome mall life and culture video. But it's sad to think like electronic stores used to be a thing. So if you'd like to get a broader look at the overall tech landscape, if you'd like to find some new content creators, some new points of view, some new conversations, and people that are really trying to dig in, build a following, or they're trying to, you know, maintain in a YouTube algorithm land that's not as hospitable as it used to be, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Excuse me. We're getting some amazing submissions. We're getting more comments. We're seeing more upvotes on the regular. How many? We picked up another new batch of subscribers. Yeah, I mean, like we're up another 20 members over last week, and this is truly grassroots. I mean, we're only just rounding up to 1,700 members. So give it a try, and where possible, try to share. Again, the active participation on this is what makes huge difference for people that are trying to make cool stuff online. You know, just passively viewing it and going, oh, it was cool, I hope they make another, doesn't help as much as you think it might. So, Gabaletta, oh man, Radio Shack, those were the days. Dave Burns, no one in my family ever had a pager, and thank goodness. Yeah, my family skipped pagers hard. I wanted one so bad. A friend of mine had one that had like a little QWERTY on it. I can't remember which model. I wanted one. I really wanted one. I even had like a Texas Instruments pocket organizer. So you could put, you know, like write little notes. And you could like organize something like 100 contacts. I don't even know 100 people. This is amazing. Is this little teeny tiny LCD ticker display and a full QWERTY keyboard. And that's when people really started making fun of me for being a nerd. And that of course carried me over into like PDAs and Palm Pilots and Windows Mobile. And it was real geeky, but yeah, I'm kind of also looking back, I'm kind of glad my parents, my family, we didn't go in hard on pagers. We went in hard on flip phones. When cell phones started getting a little cheaper, we weren't buying razors, but actually, funnily enough, like Motorola and LG smartphone cell phones, we went big on those Moto candy bars. So let's get this out of the way here. You know what? I'm gonna switch the order here real quick. I was gonna start off with Sony, but real quick, let's chat out Google. This is coming from Ars Technica. What we're expecting from Google's custom Whitechapel SoC in the Pixel 6. So a lot of this is like Google wants to dump Qualcomm. So this is a lot of speculation. But if there's any group that I've kind of enjoyed this speculative dance, I kind of like the editorial style over at Ars Technica. So this was written up by Ron Amadeo. Look, when you read through this, it's not just, oh, well, they want to do it because Qualcomm and support. So it could be cool, I guess. I don't know. Do you think a Google SoC will be good? Drop a comment down below. No, this is paragraphs of where we started, where some of these rumors are coming from. They're seeing references to chip design, what their some of their expectations are for the actual construction of this SoC, and like following up, like where other companies have run into challenges and have walked away from the mobile game, even checking out like AMD and Intel, which always made me sad that Intel gave up on their Xscale division, because way back in the day, they could have been a distinct mobile player. But here are the things that I really want to point out. So when we talk about SoC, and I'm kind of, sort of preaching to the choir here, a lot of you already know this stuff, but an SoC is system on a chip. So it's not the CPU, it's kind of everything. My expectations for a Google 6, a Whitechapel, a Google custom SoC, we'd probably be looking at some separate modem components. I don't know that Google would have the in-house to include that on the die. But Ars Technica brings up some great points. If they could bring like a visual core and neural core, those are the little core co-processors that made the Pixel 4 XL such a monster performer. Every single time you saw a Pixel 4 XL review and they just showed you a Geekbench score, that was horrifically insufficient to describe the performance of what neural core could bring to chewing up image data. To date, the absolute fastest phone I've ever worked through video rendering, video editing, video transcoding, and 4K video, like in a nearly desktop grade sort of video editing showdown, is the Pixel 4 XL. It outperforms Snapdragon 865s. It's currently outperforming Snapdragon 888s. Neural core is no joke. And that phone is still just an insane screamer at handling image data. If you're going to put that much weight on a camera and you're going to completely ignore one of the most critically impressive performers we've ever seen and still see to this day, then if you're going to ignore that, you're probably bad at tech. But the other things too, so Titan M security chip, Project Soli, maybe bringing back some of the alternative gestures, or for me, it was even just how the phone wakes up, so Soli, it was kind of silly, like when you're trying to just like listen to music and you're waving your hand over the phone to try and get it to skip tracks. I get why people focus on those fun interactions as being gimmicks. There's something unique to reaching for a Pixel 4, and as you're reaching for it, the phone is already waking up and scanning, and I still think it's the best implementation of Face ID. I do not like Face ID. I would prefer they keep a rear fingerprint sensor. I don't even like in-display fingerprint sensors. There's something I love about the Pixel 5 for just my finger lines up on the back and the phone is ready to go before I need to look at it. But with the Pixel 4, Soli Radar kind of helped recreate the phone is ready before I'm actively looking at it with Face Unlock, because the radar sensor is judging what you're trying to do before you're actually handling the device. And that's a super nuanced, super small division between how a Pixel works versus how an iPhone works. But I've never liked Face ID. I've never liked Apple's implementation because it requires more attention, more interactions, and then you still need to swipe up from your lock screen to get into the phone. It feels like everything is so much slower just getting into handling the device. So again, if Project Soli is sort of streamlined for those types of more organic interactions, it's subtler, it's simpler, it just kind of blends into the background of using the phone and it makes it feel more responsive. Again, I feel like that's as much of a benefit as 120 hertz display. There's not much that really takes advantage of 120 hertz on a phone. Most games tap out at like 40 to 60 frames per second. So you're not getting some ultra hyped, hot gaming experience, except for a handful of phones that have partnerships with individual app developers to try and drive 90 hertz in your favorite battle royale. it's not really as much of a component about the GPU. It's more the developer relationships behind the scenes. So this is one of the things that could be critically exciting for a Google SoC. I would imagine that we'd probably be in MediaTek territory for just the brute force CPU and GPU performance. Like, I don't think Google's going to come out of the gate on a first generation Whitechapel just blowing us away with CPU and GPU scores that are just completely, crazy. Like, oh man, they're just going to go right up against the A14. I would expect performance, maybe Snapdragon 700 series to Snapdragon 855, somewhere in that window. If you can deliver in that space, upper mid-range, lower premium tier, somewhere in there. But then you back it up with custom visual core, custom neural core, on chip, on SoC, security features, and on SoC biometric options. All of that could be really compelling, especially with so much of this, the fancier stuff in terms of hardware build and design, kind of going a little bit more AI, a little more automated. That neural processing was a critical advantage for Google back on the Pixel 4. Dave Burns, hey man, Cookie Clicker runs at a solid 120 hertz. I get really frustrated because I've been trying to show like, hey, where does the game like really take advantage of this? I'm going back through old articles like, does this game run at 120 hertz on a Razer 2? Does it run on an ROG 3? Does it run on a Black Shark? And I'm going through each of these apps and then I'm like, hey, okay, so like a pretty simple game, Skyforce, Skyforce Reloaded. What is this, like 3 years old now? Great top-down bullet hell shooter. I love this game. I can only play it with a stylus, but I love this game. Supposedly has support or had support for 120 hertz on the Razer Phone 2. Just pegged at 60 on every new phone I play it on. OnePlus 9 Pro, I'm getting all excited. Like, what would this little bullet shooter game look like at 120 hertz? 60 hertz. It's just like so frustrating because it's like, unless it's like whitelisted by the developer in the background of how the app is installed, it just doesn't kick up any of this extra performance tier. So I'm not, I've kind of had to flip my script on that. I'm not as impressed with high refresh. It comes with this huge battery hit. Still, even with adaptive screen tech, it still comes with a battery hit. And right now, the main thing it seems to do is make your app drawer scroll a little smoother. And that's it. Because also if your app needs to populate, so like let's say you're scanning through Google Play and you're looking at apps to install, adaptive screens don't do well when the app is populating information in the feed as you're scrolling. And you're constantly seeing this change in frame rate because the screen is adapting to the information that's stuttering on your display. So those stutters become more apparent. Like, I'll kick a OnePlus 9 down just to 60 hertz and you're like, hey, this doesn't look as smooth in my app drawer, but it actually is kind of nicer scrolling through like Instagram, because as photos pop up, the screen isn't adapting the refresh rate to the inconsistency of the data feed populating pictures. So so yeah, that's kind of fun. But short story, incredibly long, I would highly recommend checking out Ars Technica's write-up on this. I think Ron did a fantastic job of kind of cobbling together some of these other resources, what we might be able to expect. And it kind of recalls some of those memories. We get so excited about Kirin's, Huawei's processor division, HiSilicon, amazing work. Why I'm getting really anxious to see MediaTek in this space. The Dimensity 1200 sounds like on paper, this could be a phenomenal follow-up to a chip that performed really well last year. I'm going back to my LG Velvet, the T-Mobile version of the Velvet. Great performer, and in many ways outperforms the Snapdragon version of the Velvet. So competition in this space would be really critical. And if this encourages Google and enables Google to have a longer outlook It was sort of a longer term roadmap for their devices, for their support. It's already, you know, like they're already still probably the best option in Android land for day one releases, keeping older phones and less expensive phones on the same update cycle. If they can use this, this software hardware synergy to push this out to 5 years of that kind of focused product support, I'd pay more for a Pixel. We've got to stop pretending that the only reason to buy a Pixel is because they're cheap. Software support costs money. Custom SoCs, they cost money. And deriving the benefits from that means that the products should come with a higher price tag. It's the only way to properly account for, oh, but the Snapdragon 888 can outperform in this one benchmark, so it's not worth it for the monies. Okay. Phones suck because of people like you, but okay.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
I started Tech Potato with a vision. I'd already been covering processors and technology for 10 years as senior editor for Inantech, but only through the written word. With today's media so diverse, I chose to one-up my vision and move to video and explain the nuance of complex topics. Hi, my name's Ian Cutress, and I'm Chief Spud at Tech Potato. The goal at Tech Potato is to have fun, to talk about areas of the technology industry that aren't always covered. Sometimes there are non-obvious aspects to a topic which doesn't always come across in written media, and that's where I strike. The channel is also there to shine a light into the areas that most end users don't even know exist. There's also a tongue-in-cheek joke. Processors are called chips, and just like a bag of chips, I like to get my teeth into these things, hence Tech Potato. The thumbnails are stupid, but the content is real. If you're interested about how things in this technology industry work, or for reports on behind-the-scenes events, plus some classic British humor, then head on over. You'll be welcome with open arms.
Oh, Aditya. Velvet, what phone is that? Does LG still make phones? Oh, you wacky guy, you. So we're kind of getting into the end of the gadget block here, but you know, while we're talking about LG, I'm being totally honest. I'm being completely frank. I'm not completely sure what fits the mold of my next daily driver phone. It shouldn't really come as much of a surprise to folks who have been watching my streams, but you know, my V60 held onto my SIM card the longest over all of 2020 and even into the beginning of 2021. In between reviews, even sometimes concurrently with reviews, my personal SIM card, dual display, stylus support, memory card slot, quad DAC, there just wasn't any insane battery life. Even with Android 11 and my battery taking a hit, I can do better with two screens than most current flagships with big batteries can do with one screen. And if you're telling me like a slightly smoother app drawer is more worth it than having two full displays for rich multitasking, again, I'm going to kind of assume that you're not really good at this stuff. So, but I digress. I feel like one of the top picks for a phone that works for me is probably going to be Sony. First of all, for my work, I really do lean on the least hyped up auto mode HDR shots. I genuinely value having more granular camera controls and the ability to craft content, from a phone. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, a lot of this is still like shooting full auto, but even when you're in a manual mode or a pro mode, a tiny tweak to an exposure or just in the moment, I need to tap or focus here. Or it's just that one extra little step of consideration makes me so much happier with the final output. I'm so much happier with the content that I get out of something that gives me the final say on what that content should look like. And so I know a lot of people, oh, who's going to sit there and dial in all these settings? Again, you say things like that, it makes me worry that you really don't know how stuff works. So, being really snarky here. Axel Metz over at Tech Radar wrote up a list of Xperia 1 Mark III leaks, and they sound pretty impressive. I feel like some of the initial design, like concept creator, I think put out a render. A lot of this is still going to look like Xperia 1 Mark II. And again, because a lot of it still looks like Xperia 1 Mark I. But the major difference is, excuse me, I'll be curious to see if Sony puts in a higher megapixel main shooter. What the Xperia 1 made a choice on was impressively accurate and scary fast autofocus, which at the time the Xperia 1 Mark I and 1 Mark II were built, you kind of couldn't do that with these quad bear, these pixel binning sensors, 48 or 100 megapixels. They're not. They're really designed to group clusters of subpixels so that you get larger photo sites for 12 megapixel output. I mean, you still can fire up like a 64 megapixel mode. It's not really the core of what that phone's trying to do. And then when you shoot RAW, almost all of them put out 12 megapixel RAWs. So I kind of look at that like, that's the real resolution of this. And then there are just some other fun features that you can engage with for higher resolution and stuff. So I'll be curious to see if the 1 Mark III marks a change for that. Because we've seen some impressive work done for these most recent Sony sensors. The sensor on the OnePlus 9 Pro is fantastic for even like don't touch the screen but recognize someone's face. That's performance that I'd never trust on a Samsung. That OnePlus is absolutely nailing on a quad bear, on a pixel binning sensor. We're assuming that there's going to be a telephoto with an actual zoom slider, you know, a little sliding lens mechanism so that maybe we can get a more like 30 times zoom as opposed to kind of a weak, you know, 10 times optical zoom. And then the thing that I think is going to be really critical, the major aspect of comparing some of these other phones like a Galaxy S21 against a OnePlus 9, how you handle a high performance chipset. The SoC, the Snapdragon 888, was making me real anxious when I was playing with it on the Galaxy S21. Playing it with it on a OnePlus 9 makes me feel a lot better about what this chip can really do. But that means you need to properly build a phone around it to cool it and to keep the thermals in check. I think OnePlus 9 has done a markedly better job of really extracting performance out of the phone. I think Samsung went cheap, and then their solution was to pre-throttle the CPU. That to me is not epic everyday performance like Samsung marketing would have us believe. That to me is, let's get more money out of our consumers with a product that's half-baked, and we'll fix it by making the performance as slow as the two-year-old phone that they're replacing. So if any other company can come into this space with a more photography-focused or more mainstream-focused phone, I'll be curious to see how Sony handles some of this. Sony phones long in the past have had issues with thermal throttling. The Sony Xperia Pro showed us that they can incorporate some pretty impressive cooling hardware, a vapor chamber and copper piping. If you're really going to call a phone a pro, it can't overheat in the middle of a 5G broadcast. It's got to go the distance. So if some of that hardware can make it into the Xperia 1 Mark III, that puts it at the top of my list for phones to consider to replace one's fixation on LG hardware. So we'll have to see. Let's see. I'm way behind on all of these comments, y'all. I might not be able to reply too directly to all of this. F Mooney, I wish Sony would bring some new features to older phones like LG did and create a desktop mode. If they can build the PlayStation OS, they can hack together a desktop mode. Yeah, I mean, again, you know, this is our segue into LG. Man, there's just nothing as feature complete as a V60. I was in the LG V60 subreddit, and of course, a lot of people are there. Like, well, what is my next phone going to be? Should I try and sell my V60? There's a lot of uncertainty, and uncertainty is not fun when you're in this market, when you're trying to account for like how people are going to spend their money on this stuff. We live out of our phones, so I'm really trying to break it down. Like every single time. You kind of spell out like, well, an Asus can do this, this, and this, and this, and it has the Saber DAC. It has a similar DAC. Someone else will come up and be like, yeah, but what I liked was stylus support. Okay. Well, there are a couple Motos that have stylus support, and I guess after that, it's a Galaxy. You know, buying in at a Galaxy Ultra if you want a good stylus pen. And you're like, oh, but, you know, I've got this memory card. You know, I've got a 500 gig memory card. Okay. Well, there is no phone. Hold on to your V60. Get a really good armor case for it. It's frustrating because when the V60 came out, I was really positive on the V50. And in many ways, I mean, like the V50 still represents, I think, peak LG. Not only amazing mics, but the best audio processing software, 60 frame per second, 4K video on the ultra wide, a proper standalone telephoto camera sensor. If you got your hands on the South Korean model, which supported the Pogo Pin version of dual display, it really is, I think, like the absolute most complete version of any LG that's ever hit the market. So coming off of the V50, it was disappointing because here in the United States, we didn't get dual display support. So I liked the V50 because of the South Korean model, but the United States versions of these had sort of half-baked implementations of 5G. They went in hard with a Sprint partnership, and then Sprint pulled the plug on V50 support when T-Mobile finally acquired Sprint. So that was just a really sad misstep for a carrier partnership. But the V60, it was an opportunity to really take LG marketing at their word. You know, like, I'm going to keep this in a dual display case. I discovered in a live stream that it had real stylus support. Like, TK and I were, like, into unboxing the phone and then discovered, oh, it's got this pen mode. What's that about? And then, you know, like, we had to make videos on that specifically because even LG PR didn't really know that this phone could work like a note and across both screens. You know, you had a dual display with full stylus support on both screens. So I have a memory card, a really good 256 gigabyte memory card in my V60. I constantly pair it up with really thirsty headphones with Cans, my Senny 599s, my Behr Dynamic DT770s. Sound gorgeous on a quad DAC. I really ran that battery hard. My screen on time with two displays rivals the screen on time with phones with single displays. Like, I really lived it. But unfortunately, that meant I also got used to all the things an LG could do as a baby clamshell pocket computer. And now there's nothing to replace that. I'm hoping we'll see a follow-up to the Surface, but I doubt it's going to have great cameras and great audio hardware. I'm really impressed with what some of the gaming phones have been able to accomplish, but I don't think the cameras are bad, but they're not going to be LG grade. And I want features like a desktop mode. Like, I'm wrapping up a review on the U-Perfect X. It's another laptop dock. And the phone I've used with it the most is my V60. And Screen Plus got really good after the Android 11 update. I mean, like, we're in spitting distance of competing against DeX. And it's totally usable now. Like, it is for real usable for just general consumers who might want to dabble with it, as opposed to, like, the Android desktop mode. So we get to this point, and you're like, I am proper stuck because, like, I've got to make a number of compromises to replace this V60. And I'm not sure how to rank. You know, like, it sucks when you got to choose because, like, I don't got to choose on a V60. I'm just good. I'm a hardware junkie. I care about these features. I care about support. I sign all of my documents from a V60. I keep a laptop dock out on our dining room table. So when I sit down, I can just plug in my V60 and keep going from a laptop-like interface. Like, it has just become so ingrained in how I kind of utilize a mobile computer, but I try and utilize it to its fullest to really get all my money out of it. So I'm really not sure. I think Sony looks like a strong pick. I really do like what OnePlus is doing with the OnePlus 9, and I think it is a better version of the Galaxy than what Samsung could put out. But for my own personal needs, like, if I've got a pair, a high quality DAC, if it doesn't have some kind of desktop mode, if it's already got like kind of a handful of usability compromises in one area, I'm not sure if that's the phone for me. Sony's on the other side. It's like, it's lacking some of the fun stuff. It doesn't have a desktop mode either. The Android desktop mode really isn't worth playing with or trying to make functional in this exact moment. But it's so much more functional for, like, what I do for work. I'm like, maybe I need to just start shooting all of my videos in 21:9 and I'll shoot everything from a Sony. But Mr. Pulp Fiction is saying, I think Juan's next phone after LG is going to be a Sony. And then I'm just kind of curious, like, for the fun side of this is whether or not one of these gaming phones coming out might push me over into just saying, hey, you know what? I want the better cooling. I want the better chipset support. I'm just going to go with the gaming phone. They all have huge batteries, so I'll get some of my battery life fix. I'll turn down the screen resolution, the screen refresh rate, and get even more runtime out of them, and that's maybe where I'll go, and I'll just figure out ways around some of the camera issues. It's been kind of heady. Gary the Fireman, for what it's worth, my dad is rocking a K-Series LG. Simon says, Hypno, I wonder if LG will shutter it for a few years, sell the IP, or maybe come back to the smartphone market with Carl Pei or such, like in charge as a brand new division. I don't know. You know, a lot of people have kind of been talking about that because 2021 has been an incredibly difficult year for most tech players out there. We saw a super cycle of consumers buying home computing equipment. And pardon, because I've mentioned this on the podcast numerous times already, but we're under a vice grip of component shortages. Last week we talked, Xiaomi I forget who, I think it was the president of Xiaomi, was mentioning how it's very likely that the increased costs to source parts and build phones will be passed on to consumers, that we will see a rise in mobile pricing just because the stuff is getting so expensive to stockpile and to manufacture. So, you know, in the little glimmer of potential hope that I have for LG's smartphone division, it kind of makes sense. It kind of makes sense just to sit this year out. The smartphone division was already operating in the red. They hadn't been profitable in a while. They're the de facto loser in every smartphone techie gadget influencer conversation. Why not sit this year out and come back fresh in a couple years with like a, you know, sort of a more streamlined product offering or a more integrated consideration for the rest of the LG ecosystem of products. I don't know why I'm getting the feeling that it's just probably not likely this go around. I don't know why I've got like this kind of, this one has a bit more of the feeling of some finality that like this one feels like, nah, they're pretty much done. And I wonder if it's not like, you know, some of the tone of the more political commentary that comes out of South Korea, you know, they're tired of just being, you know, the punching bag for these kinds of consumer conversations. I've had some really brutal behind the scenes conversations with LG PR behind the scenes, off the record, without naming any names. But it's like you would walk away from those conversations just hearing how like disheartened, disenchanted, how exhausted they are by trying to stage some of these conversations. You know, some of it's top down, some of it's, the leadership at LG sort of demanding a certain direction for the tone of their commentary and where they want to talk about their products and stuff. But, you know, really interesting and passionate people all along the organization had different things to contribute and different things to try and different things to experiment with. And you would hear from them. You would hear in their voice, like, that's not what they wanted to do, or that's not what they thought they could have done, or they just didn't have the resources to try something bolder or more interesting. And, you know, that sucks. It sucks because after a point, I feel like LG sat back and they tried to let the product speak for themselves, but instead that just created the messaging vacuum that allowed other people to sort of define what LG would be. And for their needs, LG was more appropriate to be placed as some kind of Charlie Brown loser in the tech community. It's a bad look. I think it's a real bad look for techies. I feel like there's an art and commerce and commentary kind of conversation, a media literacy conversation that needs to happen with basically every review that gets put out. Back when I started writing tech commentary and producing tech commentary and monetizing that, like when it became like something that actually helped pay the bills, there was always sort of this agreed upon idea that like a more popular player in this space would get more coverage, but the ad sales, the money, the revenue that you would generate off of some of those larger and more high and those higher profile pieces, videos and articles, that would go into funding or subsidizing the content on smaller players and less popular players. And that way you could kind of structure a bit more of a focus on a bigger brand, but then a smaller brand would still get a more consistent application of review. Like the smaller brand wouldn't be shoved completely to the side just to be the whipping boy for a larger brand. You would have like a consistent way to test, a consistent way to review. And it was the bigger reviews that would subsidize the work needed for some of the smaller brands. And I don't really feel like that's true anymore. It's one of the things I really lay at Google's feet. Like you put all this work into a Samsung video and the numbers do really well. Google starts grading you based on that higher tier of performance. So then let's say you put the exact same amount of work into a Motorola or into an LG or into a Nokia. Well, those videos, they're not going to do as well. And as soon as Google sees the keywords LG and not Samsung, it's automatically going to hold that video back from certain search recommendations, from a good chunk of the audience that's subscribed. It's going to squish that video for you because they know that video is not going to do as well. Google stands in between you and your audience. This isn't a meritocracy. It's not even like active search as far as I can determine by trying to untangle the YouTube algorithm anymore. Now it feels proactive. Now it feels like an obvious manipulation of timeline, of subscriber feeds to try and maximize time on site in a very Facebook-like way. So I feel a number of tech publications and a lot of the larger tech influencers have kind of gleaned and leaned into this as opposed to pushing back against it. And we end up with a manipulated review cycle where look at what's happening with the OnePlus 9. A few players like Lisa's reviews, I think, are on point. We're getting the phone is actually getting into consumers' hands now. It's selling decently well, considering, you know, premium priced phones, you know, occupy a very specific niche of the market. And we're still basing so much of the commentary, especially from folks who have no interest in actually holding the phone, but they want to spit the hot takes. You know, like, I'm not going to buy that OnePlus. Their cameras are always garbage. And so-and-so said this in his review that it didn't perform as well as an iPhone. And you're like, you're talking about someone who reviewed the phone on pre-embargo software, and then that's all the commentary they're going to deliver. That is not a techie in good faith. That is a techie who is going to profit from making OnePlus the loser in a showdown or a comparison that no one asked for. That's not a review. That's an implied comparison. If you can't talk about a phone for 20 minutes without constantly bringing up Apple and Samsung, then you're really bad at this. You're not a reviewer. You're just a label fan. You're just a Samsung knight or an Apple knight. That's not difficult. If you use a product and you really try to live with it and you dig into exactly what the manufacturer is trying to accomplish, you should be able to fulfill a majority of a 20-minute review focused purely on the experience of having used that phone. And then maybe you interject a few little moments here or there to say, like, oh, well, this was different than this other phone, or this performed better than this other phone, or this is an area where they need to apply some patches. But if the entire review is just, well, it's just not as good as a Galaxy, I guess, then no, I'm going to have to like really work on my Brian Regan face for my making fun of other techie influencers. Yeah, I'm really sad. I don't know. Let me kind of scan back through some of these comments. But like I said, like, you guys have been killing it. From Hakey, techies are already starting to release videos with face covering thumbnails, completely fake lamenting and how this happened questions when the tech influencers didn't help the situation at all. Realize completely what you have been talking about, like the light would have been switched on. Techies want to be spoon-fed the reasons what the phone is for, but that should be their job to find out, like, how much lazier techies can become anymore. Yeah, I think it's a bad look. I really do. And I think it's just more evidence to kind of suggest that, like, the influence that tech influencers actually wield is decreasing and is small and isn't the kind of hype train ride that they think that they're on. It's disappointing because I kind of feel like this just further leans into the evidence that we see from, you know, those stories about how unhappy consumers are with buying a new phone. 9 out of 10 consumers see no benefit in shopping a brand new phone. And you're like, yeah, no, I get it. They've been overpromised for years. This new phone is going to be revolutionary. This new phone is going to do this. This new phone's going to do that. You have an old phone. Your phone's garbage now. Look at these bar graphs from Apple. They're not labeled in any way, but the bar graph for the new phone is bigger than the bar graph for the old phone. Are you on old phone? Why be poor? Yeah. Why would average consumers stick around for that? They left. And the folks that are now just kind of, you know, milling about in the absence of a broader consumer conversation about consumer electronics, they're not really on it, man. I know I make fun of certain Reddit communities, but like, it's getting pretty dire out there.
Hey, podcast listeners, I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, Sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Mmm, savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
The entire thing has become kind of circular and toxic, so we're not bringing many new people into our ranks. Like, we're not replenishing this audience. It's withering faster than we can regrow it. And that's a shame, because we've never been more tied in. We've never been more connected. We've never been leaning on these devices harder. We've never been trying to do more for our gadget buck. And instead of living up to that, instead of becoming a community that really does help people get more for their money, we're circling the wagons and we're making it more insular and we're being worse gatekeepers. And then we're just sort of echo chambering these truisms. If they were just more popular, they'd be better. Or if they could just make a phone that was compelling. LG just could never make a compelling phone. I've muted three people on my YouTube video that's all they had to offer. Well, if they could just make their phones good enough. And you're like, well, you've never used one. I won't miss you on this channel. Goodbye. You have wasted everybody's time and you've made the collective IQ of this comments thread poorer for you having interacted with it. From Goran Petrovic, I've had my share of pain when HTC fell. LG fall doesn't hurt at all. It's wise for the company. No one should make products they do not care about. LG makes products they passionately care about. Like, that's incorrect, Goran. Allow me to illuminate for you that the people who actually worked for LG and contributed to LG's designs, they all were very interested in making the best possible products that they could. In fact, I would say out of all the companies that we have criticized for smartphones and for decision making, I think one of the missteps for LG was that they listened to their consumers too much. This sounds backwards, but look at every single sort of iterative design change, feature change, and the kind of gimmicks that they played with. And aggressive yearly changes between bendy OLEDs into removable batteries, into a metal-backed phone, steel rails on the side. What about phones with better mil-spec drop resistance and wide-angle cameras into a phone that has a dual display, or this phone has a different kind of notch, or this headphone jack, or maybe it's a rear fingerprint sensor and a rear volume rocker. Oh, you don't want that? Let's get rid of that, and let's bring back the side-mounted volume rocker. They hyper-reacted to people in the sort of consumer electronics space criticizing those points. That's the wrong way to do it. You know, Apple got rid of the headphone jack and then just stuck to their guns. It's a terrible move in the world of smartphones and electronics. But they knew it was going to pay off. And they knew eventually people would just get on board. And they knew eventually people would just find other solutions and buy more accessories, and it would be a profitable move for their bottom line. So they just kept with it. Look at the Galaxy S21. Like, if you were looking for higher resolution screens and memory card support, those are gone. Samsung's not going to backpedal on that. They're not going to turn around on the S22 and go, you know, we really listened. People said that they wanted features like memory card support. So we brought it back again, just like we did on the Galaxy S7. Even though we sold a boatload of Galaxy S21s, we really heard you. That's not going to happen. They're not going to bring back chargers in the box. They're not going to bring back headphone jacks. They're not going to bring back memory card support. That ship has sailed because it makes them more money. And now they're going to stick to their guns. And I feel like if LG had been a little less reactive, you know, maybe we'd be into a third generation of air gestures and they would be really good now. Maybe we'd be into multiple generations of bendy OLEDs. You know, like phones like the Flex competed really well in terms of durability against like the Moto, the Moto screen, was it Shatter Shield display? you know, there's one way to make, you know, glass more rigid and more scratch resistant. There's another thing to be said for maybe making a phone more pliable so that it can survive more damage when it's out and about. You know, there are so many things that LG kind of kicked off the conversation on, and then there was a backlash. Oh, we don't want gimmicks. And then they sort of walked away from it when it could have been a more core part of their brand ID. It's not you play with a gimmick and then people like the gimmick and then you keep using it. It's you tell people they need that gimmick. You market the hell out of it. And then people go, oh yeah, this is a thing that I really use and I really, and it can't, if it's not on my next phone, I'm not going to buy that phone. And then you stick to it and you keep iterating on it and you keep improving it. Every manufacturer has had missteps with gimmicks. Every single manufacturer has pulled things out of their phones that didn't quite pan out. I think LG's problem was that would happen yearly. And that's what's frustrating. It's like, oh, LG didn't listen to their consumers. Yeah, I think LG did. I just think they got caught up in a refresh cycle that was way too aggressive. Instead of sitting down, marketing and telling folks, hey, you made the right choice in buying an LG. We're going to be along for the ride with you. We're going to be a part of this journey with you. These are all the cool things you're going to want, you're going to need, you're going to do. They would backpedal and they're like, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. We'll make the next phone different and better somehow. And that's not the way that you really court that market. Now, let me catch up to the chat here. Fat Produce has a highlighted comment. LG leading the market is going to have a bigger impact on the overall market than people think. Less competition is an open invitation to the OEMs that are left to nickel and dime consumers with hardware features and other anti-consumer practices. So yeah, I'm done writing the script. I need to shoot it for OnePlus 9 versus Galaxy S21. And it really is kind of stark how Samsung is really trying to whittle back on their phones. And they are stepping on OnePlus's turf more than OnePlus is trying to step on Samsung's turf. I know there's this techie idea of, well, OnePlus is getting too big for their britches. They need to be flagship killers. And they haven't been since the OnePlus 7s. They've just been legit competitors to what Samsung and Apple offer near similar price points. In fact, often still with some kind of cost savings built in. So I look at MSRP to MSRP, and a Galaxy S21 Plus doesn't compete against a OnePlus Pro, OnePlus 9 Pro that well. Even down into little things, like you not only get a charger in the box, you get an insanely good fast charger that can also top off laptops. The OnePlus 9 Pro has a screen protector pre-applied, matching the storage. There's a $20 price difference between a OnePlus 9 Pro and a Galaxy S21, but the camera sensors, the main sensor and the ultra wide, definitely better than the hardware that's on a Galaxy S21 Plus. The S21 Plus has a nicer telephoto, but your core photography experience so far, OnePlus has beaten it. And with some distinct hardware advantages. Faster charging, faster wireless charging. So far, I've been getting better battery life. They run more consistently. The graphics performance is way better. OnePlus phones are not pre-throttled out of the box. And we're sitting here and pretending like, oh, the OnePluses are just not quite good enough. But if I jump through hoops and I stand on one leg and I shop on the second Thursday of the month, I can get a trade-in deal and the phone will go on sale and I can get a Samsung really cheap. Like, OnePluses go on sales. OnePluses have phenomenal carrier deals happening on T-Mobile right now. OnePluses have trade-ins, or you can just sell your phone on Swappa and get money that can go towards your OnePlus. Comparing a Galaxy on sale with a trade-in against a OnePlus at full MSRP is one of the most disingenuous ways that you can rig a win for a Samsung. So yeah, what we should really do is compare the OnePlus 9 Pro against the Galaxy S21 Ultra and give Samsung a $200 advantage. Again, it's not enough that Samsung is already the implied de facto winner. It's like you also need to give them a ridiculous advantage so that they can really show you how this is going to win against the One. It's better than the OnePlus. Ridiculous. Is 21 not bigger than 9? It must be better. Yeah, McCorkran 3 is like, I love the review saying, we all know Samsung will have deals. Like, OnePlus launched on sale. OnePlus also had, like, earbuds and, I mean, I think there was also, like, a case add-on in some markets. Like, you got a case in the box, too. I mean, again, it's obviously directing the winner of your showdown to whoever has the largest audience. Has very little to do with the actual merits of this performance. As soon as I show you GPU graphs of how these phones perform in games, like, it's really clear Samsung is not holding up. and like, it's really a shame. Someone who's on a Galaxy S10 upgrading to an S21 out of the box is likely in for the same tier of performance. Like, it's not even going to be an upgrade from a 2-year-old phone. It's going to be a lateral move. And, like, that's a bummer. I mean, that makes me sad, you know, because that person is going to turn around and be a part of that statistic where 9 out of 10 people don't see any benefit in upgrading their phones. I went from an S10 to an S21 and it performs the same. Where are all our techies? Where are all the people that really try to test this stuff that do more than just show us some pretty B-roll? And talk about, you know, sort of the trends that are going to make the most sense for YouTube analytics. Like, they just don't exist anymore. It's why I've got, like, my little circle, my little crew, you know, like TK. TK actually puts the time into checking out phones and stuff. Like, he actually does his homework on them. Like, we find features on phones together that the manufacturer's PR just wasn't aware of. And it's a bummer. It really is a bummer. Increasingly, like, I'm really trying not to make this maudlin, and I wanted to make this more kind of a celebration of what I loved about LG. But, you know, especially here in North America, in the United States, a player like LG leaving is a huge hit to competition. LG was a strong number 3 in overall market share, not in sales over the last year, but in overall market share, they were still double digit. And they were double digit at almost half the market penetration of Samsung. And that's a huge chunk. I mean, a successful smartphone player can be like 3% or 4% of the market, and they can be profitable, and they can have an impact on what companies do. Depending on what analyst you follow, LG might have been as high as 12%. You know, like, that's big when Samsung pours so much money into marketing and still isn't on equal terms with Apple in the United States. So Simon says Hypno wants to know, what was everyone's favorite LG phone? What are folks thinking? I think in terms of production, I think the phone that I probably used the most, yeah, probably V50. V50 really shot us to that next level. 4K 60 frames per second. Software stabilized on both the main sensor and the ultra wide. I loved playing with the dual display on the V50 for the Korean model. I'd probably put my vote there, even though stylus support on the V60 was a huge perk. Let's see. McCorkran 3. After I traded in my S20 Ultra, my phone was only $200. Yeah, but you traded in a $1,400 phone. Loco Rudy. Oh, sorry. JMX Warrior saying, I really liked the G5, but I'm loving my G6. G6 is still in operation today. We didn't travel this whole last year, but the traveling we did at the end of last year, the G6 was Lex's phone. Like, just a memory card full of movies. And that was the phone that she would watch movies on. Loco Rudy saying the V20. Dave Burns, V30 was an amazing phone. Mr. Malignance is saying V30 Plus. Simon says Hypno, 'twas the V60 for me, closely followed by the G2 and the Pixel 2. A lot of G6 love in here from Heike and Aditya. Oh, no, from Allgreg and Heike. Aditya is saying my LG G7. What was it? It was a phone that helped me out of a bad phase of my life, helped me understand and recognize my passion for good audio and photography. G7 is still the phone that's gone the longest for Marie. My wife has this tendency of killing good phones, and her G7 lasted the longest. It still kind of got wrecked at the end there, but we just recently, okay, sorry, this is a quick tangent. We did a podcast talking about her experiences, the actual daily operation of her Pixel 4a 5G. She's digging it. This phone is smooth. It's sleek. The camera's great. You know, she's not feeling anything lost there. 2 days ago, she's got some really nice earbuds from Mi Audio. She's got the MX3s. They're triple driver earbuds. She came up to me and was like, hey, you know that video you did a while back on that Bluetooth thing that could, like, connect headphones? And like, it was supposed to be pretty good. Can we get me one of those? And they're like, well, yeah. The Pixel's fine. The Pixel's good. The Pixel's fine. But you know, it's not the same as my LG was. And also maybe I'd like to be untethered. Like maybe I'd like to use my nice earbuds and not be connected to my phone. So my wife is now using a Fio BTR3 for really nice earbuds, even though the Pixel 4a 5G has a headphone jack. My non-audiophile wife, who's never worked in recording and doesn't listen to a ton of music, she just watches a lot of streaming video and she streams a lot of shows on Netflix and other services. Even she was like, just something that's going to power these earbuds a little bit better. So Aditya, you're very good company with an LG G7. I lost my place in the chat. Let's see. Sorry, I got to scroll back up here. There we go. From Collared Word, G5, modularity for the win. 2 Turbo 0 had many friends jump from iPhones to the G2 and G3. Daybo9 never owned one, but was most excited for the V30. V30 is such a clean phone. I really, really liked the V30. Dave Burns, I bought a Note 8 and I was wrong. V30 was the phone to choose. Now, I can't fault people shopping Note 8 and Note 9, though. Note 8 and Note 9 represent like the last true ideas of what a Note for that year should be. And from Note 10 on, it's just been, how can we remove features and how can we keep you paying the same for a phone that does less stuff? Sentinel 909, I used and loved my V20, but I wish I had the V10 when it came out. Still love that design to death. However, my favorite and the one I still use is the LG Nexus 5. Now, that one got a lot of love on my video. Lots of comments just like, hey, it's not just LG phones. They also made my favorite Nexus. Really, really clean. What do we got? Andre, I liked the G3 with the fancy case, the one with the window that would show the time. Gormlord, was it the V20 that had the awesome second screen up top? So V10 and V20 both had ticker displays. Ticker displays were so cool. I really liked, and especially like you would use your main screen for like your camera viewfinder, and then you would have this little ticker display for extra like camera features. It was really cool. I really liked the way they did that and how that feels so much different. It feels so much more different than like a notch. You know, it's so funny. I mean, like the psychology of a 16:9 display with a teeny little ticker is demonstrably different than having a 20:9 display, but with a cutout in the display where content can go. It's so funny. I mean, those little differences, those little nuances mattered so much. Collared Words, I wish my G7 would die, but it's just a monster. Just run it into the ground. Let's see. Gorin, my G7 will stay as a music player since 3.5 millimeter is now definitely dead. Aditya Anil, the Nexus 5 was a little beast. I loved mine. Doomer, the S20 FE is the last S series phone with an SD card. That's why I picked it, which I think you made a solid buy, especially compared against an S21. You know, what's kind of a shame is, like, I kind of feel G6 to G7 was our last hurrah. We saw the changes in design. LG was ahead of the curve on 2x1 displays. Like, the G6 was 18x9 or 2x1 if you reduce your fractions. And it's a shame because, like, by the time we get to the G8, G8 and V50, I think, are peak LG. V60 occupies a different kind of modularity and is still a phenomenal diesel truck of a workhorse phone. But G8, fingerprint sensor, face unlock, palm unlock, gestures were kind of silly, but they were functional. Quad HD display, quad DAC, 60 frame per second software stabilized video from the main sensor and the ultra wide. G8. Now that I'm saying it, like, the last proper smaller form factor premium tier LG phone, like, it just ticked every box. It was a proper true competitor against what Samsung had to offer with the S10. You could buy it for cheaper. It launched on a crazy sale price. Like, you could get it for like $650 or something like that, completely unlocked. That, you know, that year, 2 years ago, LG, I feel like that was our high watermark. And unfortunately from there, it's more about trying to find a better balance of cost savings and performance. It's really a shame. A two turbo, my G8 was a boss. The G8's still really good. I mean, again, that hardware is fantastic. And we're at that tier, you know, like Snapdragon 855s, like, they're monster performers still. You know, you can pick up a Snapdragon 700 series phone and it's still going to get murked by an 855. I cannot stand how large the smaller phones are getting. So it's sad. The phone that got me on the LG train was the Optimus Pro. It was the Fablity Optimus that I believe it came out somewhere around the Note 3. But that's the one that kind of piqued my interest and got me more interested in what LG was doing. And from there, it was just like a steady run of G3 to G4. G5 was the phone that let me down. We went through three of them at Pocket Now, and I just couldn't get that vibe. And then immediately the turnaround from G5... you know, from V10 to V20, the V20 was just a phenomenal performer. It was just a monster phone. And that was a phone that many of my friends went the distance on. Even 2 years ago, I believe my buddy Trisha, she was still using a V20 for some of her event footage and coverage. Because it was like, she had this mic, she liked this headphone jack, she could put it on a gimbal. V20 ran until it, like, literally could not boot anymore, and she went years on a V20. V30, beautiful design. V40 was kind of a weak spot phone for me. That was one of the ones where I was still mostly leaning on AT&T devices, and I think it was that flavor of the V40 was the poorest supported. I sent the V40 back to LG to try and get them to flash it, and then, like, just never got around to replacing it. And the AT&T flavor of the V40, was it the V40? I'm pretty sure it was the V40. Just wasn't very good. But then G8 and V50 rocked my socks. So it's been an interesting journey. It's been an interesting trip. And I'll probably be putting together some vlogs or maybe some shorts just talking about some of my personal feels. Like, I kind of feel like I need to be clear and upfront about what my challenges and what my preferences are. You know, like, if I'm not spelling out what my bias is, then I don't feel like you're getting an accurate representation of why I grade certain phones the way I do. But it's interesting. Right now, my SIM card's in a OnePlus 9 Pro, and I really dig it. But every single time I set that phone down and I want to watch some video, or I'm cooking in the kitchen and I want to have a live stream up, I miss having a dual display. I miss being able to just like prop up a Velvet and have a recipe on one screen and, you know, my friend's YouTube feed, my YouTube stream on the other. Like, to think we had a phone that cost as much as a Galaxy A71 that was two full phones stapled together with full stylus support and built as well as the Velvet.
And we still just couldn't figure out how LG would be good enough. This is a better phone in almost every metric than a plastic built Samsung A series, but I don't know, just LG can't find their hook.
So, we can probably put a pin in it. I've got a more dour and a more serious video kind of talking about some stuff that you've regularly heard me discuss on this podcast. I'm going to have some OnePlus content coming out shortly. I'm ready for a bunch of Reddit haters to come out and call me a OnePlus shill now, that I might be saying some nice things about OnePlus.
Guess he's, you know, going to jump the bandwagon because he can't get LGs anymore.
So I hope they all, like, you know, sort of break their fingers on their keyboards. I wish them ill. I don't, not really, but I kind of do, but not really, but maybe a little. So, folks, we've got a lot of content coming out, and I made a lot of stuff last week. So yeah, there's a bunch. There's gonna be quite a bit to dig into. Wrapping up my review on the T-Rex, wrapping up my review on the U-Perfect X. I got some great headphones, some Ultrasones, some German audio engineering. So I'm going to be excited to talk about that. I still need to pop out a video on the Pinnacles. So those earbuds from Mi Audio, which are really sweet for single driver earbuds. It's going to be interesting. I feel like a part of what needs to pivot on this channel is just getting away from, and I've said this before, and I still failed to find my way out, but getting away from the review after review after review after review. And instead, I really want to focus on using these things more and kind of practicing what I preach and getting people into the excitement of opening that new box. And I look at so many of my family members and, man, they're exhausted if they need to buy a new phone. So now's the right time to shift that up. And maybe it's fitness challenges, and maybe it's tutorials on making fun videos for your family and friends. There's more we could be doing. So I hope you're along for that ride, because I think that ride will be a lot more fun than just repeating all of the press releases from the two top brands in the United States and then acting like that's what a review was. So folks, be on the lookout, because again, the support, the participation, the interactions, they mean the world to me. This stuff wouldn't be fun if we didn't have a community of folks here that was more interested in kind of a broader and a more nuanced tech conversation. So, on that note, I want you all to have a fantastic week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I hope to see everyone back here next week for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Be well. Take care. It's still real crazy out there. And things are getting better. I'm actually really happy to say things are looking up. So let's stick to it. I think we can get there. I love you all. I'll catch you back.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration,
And I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.